We're going to turn the recorder on, so, all right, we are back to order. All right, at this time, we'll continue with Mr. Armstrong. Questions from Mr. Armstrong and or Mr. Lean?
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Do you have Exhibit 3 available to you?
Yes.
Am I correct in understanding that Exhibit 3 within the red lines is where you're asking, what you're asking to be cited for the facility?
Yes, I would describe that as the boundary of the project.
And within that exhibit, the green is participating landowners, and the white parcels are non-participating landowners.
That's correct.
Why is there so much white?
The different reasons for folks not participating in the project range from just not being interested in encumbering their land to us not being able to lease it because of a title problem. It just varies from person to person.
Do you know, have any estimate of how many landowners are involved who have decided not to participate within the project boundaries?
I don't have that number at hand, but there may be somebody here that can answer that.
Have any of them stressed strong objection to the project in the area that you're aware of?
No.
Are you still trying to lease some of those landowners?
Yes, we're talking with a few of them.
You know which ones on the map?
The landowners in sections 2, 12, and 1 of Township 142, Range 63 come to mind. I'm sure that there are other folks that we are talking to as well.
Have any of the non-participating landowners been contacted and discussed where the turbines are going to be located to see if they had any issues as it affects their property?
I'm not certain on all of them, but I know that we have talked with some of them, yes.
What was done to accommodate non-participating landowners as far as turbine locations?
We've applied the commission setbacks as well as the Stutsman County setbacks for those folks.
Well, the reason I guess I ask those questions is in the application it indicated that a facility siting workshop was planned in the spring of 2013. Did that occur?
Yes, it did.
Tell us, what was the purpose of that and what happened there?
The goal of our siting workshop is to work with the landowners who are going to be hosting project facilities and to identify locations that, when we were doing our preliminary layout that we might have missed, important things on their land or identify farming practices that could be better accommodated with modifications to the project design, those sorts of things.
Okay, so at least that workshop anyway just included participating landowners.
Yes.
Has there been any effort to discuss the final layout with non-participating owners within the project boundaries?
I know that we have discussed it with some of the non-participating landowners. I don't know. I cannot say for sure that we have discussed it with all. I know that some of the non-participating landowners are non-participating simply because we can't get contact with them.
Okay, so there's a number that you can't locate. There's some who don't want to lease, and there may be title issues, so you don't want to, you or Geronimo or Courtney Wynn doesn't want to lease if there's a title issue.
Yes, we would be incapable of getting title insurance for the project in those situations.
Is there more than a handful of who have said, we don't want a lease, we don't want the project here? Do you have any numbers that we can figure out?
As far as objectors to the project?
Yeah.
I'm not aware of any objectors.
Then there's some areas on the map I want to talk to you about, and let's start with the town of Courtney. Why is it part of the town included within the boundaries?
The boundary of the project was drawn to the project parcels, and one landowner actually owned a parcel that extended over into the town. The town's boundary didn't follow his parcel line. So when we signed an easement with him, we signed an easement for the whole parcel of land and leased it into the town of Courtney.
And not necessarily quoting the rule here, but it says you can't, we're not supposed to site in a incorporated city unless there's no reasonable alternative. Is there no reasonable alternative to avoiding the city of Courtney, or can we go along the boundaries of there if this project is approved?
Because of the way the lease is written, the lease is for his whole parcel, so our easement will extend into the city of Corbin.
But our certificate doesn't necessarily have to. Are you going to have any facilities in the city of Courtney?
No, we've treated the city of Courtney as an exclusion area when we've been designing the project.
And how final are the locations of the turbines on Exhibit 3?
The turbine locations on Exhibit 3, you know, they're subject to very final design, but that typically has shifts of 100 feet or less.
So it
would be not perceivable based on what the scale of this map is.
So what I understand is you pretty much locate where the final turbine locations will be, but there may be less depending on which turbine you use.
That's correct.
And you used, in evaluating the setbacks, you evaluated that based on the tallest turbine possible for the project.
Yes.
Do you know, if there's more generation from the turbine, you said there'd be less turbines, and if there's less generation, there'd be more turbines. What makes you decide whether to have the less generating turbine or the more generating turbine?
It's ultimately a cost decision. So the wind turbines themselves are the single largest cost for the project, and having a diversity of choices while we're still negotiating those contracts is very important for us to have commercial leverage.
So, have you determined if you have the smaller generating turbine, how many turbines you'll likely have versus if you have the largest generation of turbines? What's the difference?
The difference is 33 turbines between the two.
And then when conducting the noise and shadow analysis, I guess in my mind, I think the smaller generating turbine, since you're going to have more of them, is going to create more noise and potentially more shadow. Is that correct?
I don't necessarily want to speak to the noise analysis because that wasn't an analysis we performed internally. But from a shadow flicker standpoint, there's a combination of issues at hand. You have both the rotor area, so the turbines that have a rotor width that are wider will, on an individual basis, generate more flicker because they're larger. And then you also have the number of turbines, and so turbines where there is flicker overlap is also a source for increased flicker. So it isn't necessarily one turbine or another turbine that has a greater environmental impact in those scenarios.
The question I have is for, say, the shadow flicker analysis, do we have the information for all the potential turbines on the project?
Yes.
And that's all included within the shadow flicker?
Yes.
And for whichever the four may be selected, it's going to be below the commission standards, the 30 hours per year you talked about for the industry standards.
Yes.
And for the noise, am I correct? You would not be the person to testify about the decibel level.
I would defer that.
Do you know if the noise analysis, below 50 and then also below Stutzman County's level, is below with all potential turbine models being considered for the project?
I would also, I think that's going to be covered in Carl's testimony.
I apologize for jumping around here a little bit, but looking at the map, what impacts will there be to the non-participating landowners' property from this project?
Very minimal. I think it would primarily be that there's they can see the wind turbines around their property. I would say that there's also probably a small amount of flicker that might extend onto their parcel, probably not to their residence. You know, I don't want to talk about the noise particularly, but I know that that does spread across the landscape.
It spreads across the landscape.
Yeah, it is something that travels across an area and may extend slightly onto a parcel, whether or not it goes to their home, I cannot say.
As I understood, and I just want to make sure, because there's quite a bit of wetland area within the project boundaries, you'd agree with that, wouldn't you?
I would describe it as having a wetland agricultural matrix.
Am I correct that all access roads and collector lines are going to be avoiding any wetland easements by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service?
Yes. While we do have facilities that are sited on wetland easement parcels, we've worked with the service to identify where their jurisdictional wetlands are, where their, I guess, maybe not jurisdictional, but their easement wetlands are, doing co-delineations on site. And then we've been able to ensure that our final design of our project avoids all of those.
So as I understand it, you're avoiding all the wetland easements, but some of your facilities may be located on wetlands.
On parcels where there are not wetland easements, we have also attempted to avoid wetlands as much as possible. And we are below the Army Corps' nationwide permit threshold, so we would qualify under the nationwide permit, but complete avoidance was not possible.
What did you do to minimize the impacts then, as far as what you'd impact is in wetlands?
We would identify the wetland boundary, and then we would slightly modify either a turbine road or a turbine position by a few feet. Typically, we'd been successful in identifying those wetlands early on in the project through desktop review, because they are readily apparent on aerial
photos. Is what you're talking about the continual reviewing and the final engineering that you've discussed, is that kind of what we're dealing with here with the late filed, I guess, for the waters and wetlands, was late filed Exhibit 17. There's still some additional information that'll be coming on
yes,
that.
Yes.
And as far as late filed 15, I guess I understood that that's the supplemental memo on the unsurveyed areas for the Class 3 survey.
Correct.
And the late filed 16 is the supplemental memo on what I guess I call a Class 2 survey, but also called an architectural survey.
Correct.
And you're anticipating SHPO concurrence on those unsurveyed areas?
Yes, we've worked closely with SHPO.
And as I understand, we don't have State Historical Preservation Office concurrence, I guess, on any of the surveys to date. Is that correct?
We have concurrence on methodology, but the results of the surveys still need to be reviewed.
Okay. Are those in the process of being reviewed now?
Yes.
And just, I guess, counsel for my information, it's my understanding late file 15 and 16 would include SHPO's review of the entire surveyed area, not just the unsurveyed areas on a map that's Exhibit 7. Is that correct?
That is correct.
I heard in your testimony, and I think it's different than the application, did I understand correctly that there is now a power purchase agreement in place?
That's correct.
Sometimes we call that an off-taker?
Yes.
And then what needs to be done to sell the electricity afterwards is that connecting line to Otter Tails substation once
that's
this is completed?
Yes.
But as I understand it, Courtney Wind is going to continue operating the facility? Is that the plan at the time?
That is the plan.
Some of these next questions may have more to do with the other witness today, but you talked about the correspondence with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Yeah.
And as I kind of going through the file, there was birds,
mm-hmm.
And there was wetlands that were at issue.
You must answer verbally.
Yes. Yes. Sorry.
They used to call it the avian and bat protection plan, but now apparently it's the bird and bat conservation strategies.
That's correct.
When you develop that and submit it to U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, what do they do with it at that point?
The bird and bat conservation strategy is a document that we actually use. We develop it based on input from them, and then we go out and we implement that plan on the operating project.
Do you submit that or give the final version to U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for some purpose or for its review?
We give it to the Fish and Wildlife Service for their review and for their information.
We used to, and I probably used the wrong words, but I guess I used to call it a incidental take permit, where it would basically say, you know, if these turbines are up and a protective bird flies into them or something, if you've done everything they wanted you to do beforehand, they would basically not charge you, if you will. But is that kind of what the purpose of this is, or what's the end game, I guess, with the bird and bat conversion strategies?
The principle.
Conservation strategies.
Yeah, the principle of the BBCS is not necessarily addressing endangered species, which you would do under an HCP, but it's really to address more broadly migratory birds, which are protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. The service has developed extensive guidelines in cooperation with the wind industry and in cooperation with NGOs such as Audubon Society and Defenders of Wildlife on how to assess a project, and then during operations how to monitor its activities. And we have developed a number of reports, our Tier 2 environmental assessment, our avian surveys from this past fall and spring, which would qualify as a Tier 3 under those guidelines, and then the BBCS, which would come typically under what they would call Tier 4, which is an operational standard. And it allows us for ongoing monitoring of the project and making sure that, that we are truly doing our best to minimize our impacts to migratory birds.
Because as I understand it, this project in the central flyway for, not the whooping crane corridor, but for a lot of federal waterfowl.
I'd need to defer that to Carl to talk a little more about the species that would come through the area.
I guess the broader question to you is, what impacts would you expect this wind farm to have on wildlife in the area, including birds?
Again, I'd probably defer that to Carl.
Do you know what the status is as far as U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service? And there's a lot of information between Courtney or Geronimo and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service here, but is there a point where you would expect Fish and Wildlife Service to say, we approve this wind farm, or we're fine with it, or here's more that we recommend, or is it just a continuous ongoing discussion?
From previous experiences, it's more been an ongoing discussion about what to do in certain scenarios.
And I saw in the exhibits, I think the updated exhibits that we got this morning, that there's currently something going on with an eagle nest in the area?
Yes, and I'd probably defer most of those questions over to Carl as well.
Okay.
have nothing to do.
Thank you, Mr. Armstrong. Mr. Lean, did you have any? Okay.
Thank you.
This time we'll go to the commissioners for any questions, beginning with Commissioner Call.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Patrick, for your testimony. And Molly, as always, you always anticipate half the questions we're going to ask, so I appreciate that. And Mitch's follow. Mitch talked quite a bit about the white spots in the green map. And I'll close with that line of questions, because I'm not comfortable with that at all, to tell you the truth. So just to finish that up with that. But before we get to that, I want to just go through the standard questions. So you said about 2,000 jobs or 200 jobs during construction. What do you anticipate when the construction is done? How many jobs would this be?
We anticipate between 10 and 14 folks needing to operate the project.
Okay, so they have housing and they would live in Jamestown or their Carrington or Courtney?
That's correct, yeah. It's somewhere, one of the local communities nearby.
Okay, perfect. Any idea of what kind of tax base this would bring into the counties?
I think it'll bring in some pretty significant tax base. I don't have the number off the top of my head, but I know it was in the application.
Okay, fair enough. Let's see here. You talked about the interconnection. With an Otter Tail line, you have to build your own 115, which is below our jurisdiction. But I'm trying to figure out, when are you going to decide what turbines you're going to use? But it's always going to be a 200 megawatt interconnection, no matter how you would do that, correct?
That's correct. Yeah, the structure, the way that MISO looks at it is that they just want to see what power is being put into the grid, and they'll look, you know, from a high level at you know the fact that it's a wind energy facility, but the turbine models don't affect their analysis all that much.
Okay, so it doesn't matter if it's coming from 133 spots or 100 spots, as long as it's 200 megawatts, give or take, in the max.
Yep.
Fair enough. When will you decide that point of whether you're going to do 133 or 100? I'll push a little harder on that decision time frame, because that's 33 turbines, which the white dots in the thing, that might make a difference where those 33 turbines are taken away from.
We are working hard to, you know, select a vendor, because it goes into some of the very fine detail things like cable sizing and the like that will help us to get under construction. But I don't have a final deadline right now.
But you must know a latest deadline if you're going to start production by 2014.
I think the latest deadline would probably be sometime in September.
Of this year?
Of this year.
Okay, fair enough. I'd never heard of anything like the Courtney Wind Farmers LLC. I don't know if that's really a siting jurisdiction, but I'm just curious how that was going to work, a little more details about that.
You know, the way that it's structured, it basically follows the SEC rules for these sorts of things, and you know, they are a completely separate entity from us. So, what, as I understand it, I've not been privy to how Courtney Wind Farmers has run.
How can they be separate from you if you're running the wind farm?
Well, we provided them with the opportunity to invest in the project, and they said, okay, then this LLC gets set up, and through this LLC we will use that as the vehicle.
So they're going to put up capital to help build this?
Their investment is in the development end of the project, so funding environmental studies, funding real estate work, surveys, ultra surveys, engineering, things like that is where their funding goes to.
So where will we find the list of people that are part of this? It must be public record. I'm just curious if we've got people that are living inside the footprint are not participating, but you could have someone from Texas or wherever investing in this project.
You know, I'm not personally privy to the list of folks because of SEC rules. I don't think we're allowed to know that. I think it's possible that one of the board members of Courtney Wind Farmers is here and might be able to answer your questions later.
Okay, fair enough. You talked about a potential power purchase agreement. Who is that signed with?
I'm not totally sure that I'm allowed to disclose that right now, but I know that it will be disclosed publicly very shortly.
This is the first time, I think in my time in the commission, we've sited almost 1,500 megawatts of wind. And so every farm has its own uniqueness about it. So I've never seen permanent met towers on the site design. And I'm wondering why they're going to be there, and I guess why are they going to be there?
They allow us to hold the turbine manufacturers accountable for the information that they provide us on the turbine's operations that we put into our financial model. So if they say that at a wind speed of 8.4 meters a second, the turbine will be generating X amount of energy, we've positioned these based on a set of IEC standards so that we can actually verify that operations.
Okay. So you're not able to verify that with what power company? Jerry would probably know more about that, but I can ask him operate. But your thought is that's a quality control of your own project, if you will?
Yes. It gives us a lot of great information data on how the turbines are actually operating, what the wind conditions are that are affecting those turbines.
We've heard a lot from the aerial sprayers with concerns about met towers, especially early on, and I think that once the turbine's in place, that'll kind of work itself out. But did you have to have any special approval to keep those met towers up permanently, and any special markings you're going to put on?
Yeah, these towers are not currently installed. They'll be installed as part of the construction of the project, but we did go through our standard set of approvals and registrations when we installed our temporary met towers on the project.
Okay, so you don't need anything special that you're aware of to leave them there permanently?
No, we'll need permits from both the county and we'll need to register them as well.
With the FAA?
With the FAA, and I believe the North Dakota has a registration.
Fair enough. The Stutsman County Ordinance, the noise was more restrictive. Was there anything else that was more restrictive?
They've got a number of setbacks that are calculated, I would say, differently, and in certain situations they end up being more restrictive. There's some that are calculated based on a rotor diameter multiplier. I think if memory serves, that it is 5 rotor diameters from a home. And that, in certain situations, ends up being more restrictive than the PSCs.
Okay. And just for the officials in the crowd, I always personally like when counties do this kind of thing. Let the counties pick what they want for their own ordinances, and then we come up with our general rules. But it's really nice when the counties tweak it to what they want to do. It really helps out. And you talked about 1,400 feet. I don't believe we have 1,400 feet anywhere in any rules or guidelines. It's just that's kind of the commission breakpoint that we'd use for 1.5 megawatt turbines, which may be different as we get bigger turbines. But I just throw that out there. I don't think that's a hard, fast rule. When would the turbines actually be assembled? What month?
It's a little difficult for me to say right now. I can give you a best guess, which would probably be starting sometime in June of next year.
Okay, so it's summer time frame, perhaps. And the reason I bring that out is, are you familiar with when we had there was a turbine failure up in Rugby where basically the whole rotor head just fell off?
I think I remember reading about that in the news.
In the after action of that, it came out that it was assembled in the winter, the coldest day possible. It wasn't quite synced up, so they really tried to avoid assembling these things in the winter just if at all possible. And the second thing, your blades, have you had any of these turbines, any of them have any blade failures? We've seen not very many, but 2 blade failures in farms we've cited before.
To the best of my knowledge, none of the turbines that we're proposing have had blade failures, but I need to look through records to be certain.
Okay. 30 years is what you anticipate the life of these particular turbines. What is that based on? Are there some of these that have been in production 30 years, or is this just a guess?
It is really just what the manufacturers tell us they think the operational life could extend to. None of these particular models have been in operation for 30 years, but definitely some in places where there was early wind development, like Palm Springs, there are turbines that have been up that long.
Okay, and that kind of ties into my questions about the decommissioning plan. Whenever the time comes, whether it's this generation of turbines or the next one, how do you go back and put the land the way it was? Do you take pictures now of this is what the landscape looked like, so then 40 years from now you can put the hills in the right spot and put everything back together?
We do actually take a number of aerial photos of our projects before we go into construction, and those will serve as a record for decommissioning. And then, we've got a significant amount of documentation as far as topography and other site characteristics about each of the turbine locations. And that gets gathered in a lot of the preliminary surveys that we do as far as wetlands and cultural, because we have people that go out and check all of these locations.
Okay. Do you set aside some money for decommissioning to where at some point in time you quit selling electricity to your customers, so there's got to be some money to do all these things? Are you going to set aside some percentage of revenue or put a bond in place for this?
What we'll do is we'll develop a whole very detailed plan that may include us setting aside funds at some point in the operations of the project.
Would you be against having a bond in place for these projects for decommissioning?
I wouldn't necessarily oppose it, but we'd need to look at things like the timing and the amount and the way that bond gets administered.
And you anticipated my next question. How do you calculate the cost of putting this back to the way it was?
We work really closely with the construction company to develop an estimate of what it's going to cost to decommission it. And our best estimate is going to be based on, today's dollars. So there's got to be a number of assumptions about inflation. And we also look at salvage value in the context of decommissioning, because there is a significant amount of steel and copper and other bits and pieces that can be resold. So we're also typically making an estimate off of, what long-term salvage value of those things are going to be.
Okay. The cement pads, how much of those do you remove on decommissioning? Do you take the whole pad out? Do you get out to a certain depth?
We'll decommission them down to approximately 4 feet, if memory serves. And we'll then put topsoil on top of that and regrade and decompact so that the surface is essentially what it was before.
Are the collector lines left in place, or do those come out?
If the collector lines are below 4 feet, I think we would typically leave them in place.
Is that what drove you to put them in deeper so you could leave them when you're done, or is that more of a safety concern?
It was more of a safety concern, and also it was a re-review. We're looking at the commission standards again and noticed that the commission standards said 4 feet for collection lines.
All right, thank you. You wrote a little bit about the airbase up in Grand Forks, but did you talk to the airport or the airport in Jamestown at all that they had any concerns about this?
We haven't talked to the airport directly. We've addressed aviation concerns associated with airports through the FAA's procedures, which is typically how they ask us to deal with those things.
The reason I bring that up is we did some work west of the airbase in Grand Forks, and we had the aviation school at UND come out, and they were very concerned because, I'm not a pilot, basically the turbine's spinning. If you have airplanes that don't have repeaters, they can't see them coming in. And so we need to ask someone about if Jamestown is used by UND school. I don't know where we'd even begin to find that. So maybe that's something we can talk to on break, or the mayor. I see her nodding her head back there. Maybe she has some thoughts. But it's just that's one of those concerns that maybe wouldn't be directly thought of, but just because we've been around the state quite a bit, we've seen that come up before. Mm-hmm. Okay. Only a couple more lines of questions. The one is, Mitch talked a little bit about it, the Habitat Conservation Plan. I know that we have our environmental expert coming next, but I think this is more of a management decision, is that your Exhibit 6 says that they recommend that you contact Migratory Bird Office to discuss the need for a take permit from the service. So are you going to be asking for a take permit?
I think the email that you're talking about is in context of the eagle nest that we're working on
okay.
with the service. And it's a different process than what would be gone through for an endangered species. It's actually called an eagle take permit. It was set up in a 2009 rulemaking process.
Deals with the eagle. Back to the Whooping Crane Flyway, Mitch set it up, but it's my understanding that if a company is participating in a habitat conservation plan, if an endangered species is taken, there's no potential fine that goes to the owners of the project. If you don't do that, you could be subject to it. So it seems to me like that would be something you'd really want to do. Otherwise, you expose your people that invest to a lot of risk.
I would say that an HCP seeking an incidental take permit for an endangered species is a business level decision because they're not mandatory permits, but as you note, they do have there is significant liability if you do take an endangered species. The way that the service has set up their wind energy guidance is through this tiered assessment of the project. You identify different risks associated with the project and with particularly with avian and bat interaction. And for this project, as we've been reviewing it, we've identified that it's actually pretty low risk from an endangered species standpoint. And one of the things that the service generally guarantees you is that while you're going through the steps that they've laid out that they feel are prudent, as long as you determine that the project is low risk, they don't feel that you should go and seek a take permit. It would create extra work for them and be expensive for us. So that's how we've determined that we don't need it.
And you would only be selling this power to potentially an investor-owned utility or someone else. You never envision, I shouldn't say never, but I will tell you, as a regulator, if I would find out that a company, an investor-owned, tried to build a wind farm, a bio wind farm, and didn't have that take permit, that'd probably be a showstopper, because the risk you might put ratepayers to. And so if your goal is to sell power, that's your risk to take. That's what I see. Do you see it that same way?
I think that it's a project level and a project by project determination as far as what the risk actually is of any particular site.
If there was something that got levied a fine, it would be yours to bear, not who you sell the power to.
That would be correct.
Okay, that's probably the key question. And the last one, just to follow up, is I'm just really trying to get my head around how there can be so many non-participating landowners in this footprint. I've never seen anything. Not to get argumentative, but I've never seen anything like this before.
I think in general, it's really only a handful of people, but they just own a lot of land.
Okay, so give me the number then. How many participating landowners do you have?
How many participating landowners?
How many non-participating landowners are in there? To put some numbers on what you just said.
I believe that we have around 80 participating landowners. I don't know the number of non-participants, but I know it's very low.
Could we get a late filed exhibit on that?
Yes.
Why don't we just see if somebody else has the information, and then we'll get back to you after.
Because I'd like to get some names of these non-participating landowners too.
I will note that, and we'll get into this, but Stetson County has setbacks requirements from non-participating landowners, and those were part of what was complied with. And we do have a hearing process in order to provide that notice to those particular landowners, including those that have, that are in the project area. So, we'll go on.
Thank you.
So I'm unclear. Are you asking for that to be filed, Commissioner?
Somewhere today, if we can get the information verbally from a witness, that would be great. If we can't, late filing. Maybe we'll have to talk through some more on this, but if we've got a project boundary and you have people that are not participating, how could they be inside the project boundary?
Ultimately,
wouldn't we have to change the project boundary?
We define the project boundary as sort of the area that we're studying and the area that that we want to understand what our impacts are from on a sort of that scale of the landscape, and then from there we can design our site appropriately. So we use our project boundary more broadly, not just as far as who's participating and who's not participating, but it's also sort of an analysis area.
Why on these, looking at exhibit number 3, in the bottom left corner, you've got the project boundary going outside of the green area. Is that because the same thing, the one landowner owns all of that? Or is that a...
Possibly. I don't know that off the top of my head.
Okay, I think maybe just let that go and then we'll circle back around. So thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Christman.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to start off, and I'm paraphrasing, not quoting, but if these are fairly accurate to what you said earlier, that one of the things that brought you to this area and to this project was that the landowners were excited about it.
That's correct, yes.
And at another point you mentioned that you're kind of seeing them as innovators who want to increase the income for themselves and for the area.
That's correct.
Okay. When you go out and negotiate with landowners, let me just tell you for background, from my state senate days in my district, I've had a wind farm where I got some landowner complaints, and I've had another wind farm where they just didn't seem to come. Maybe, I don't know if they were upset or not, but they didn't seem to be. Heard nothing on that one. When you send your agents out to negotiate with landowners, is it kind of a old-fashioned business buyer beware kind of thing, and you do what it takes to get the easement? Or are your agents out there trying to make sure they understand the pros and the cons, and a landowner that maybe hasn't been exposed to this kind of thing understands that there could be some noise or some flicker or something like that? Do you lay out the pros and the cons of the industry?
As far as the training for the project managers who are out there acquiring easements and working on these on a day-to-day basis, their training is to be as transparent as possible. That's our company's philosophy. You know, we don't want to sugarcoat any information. We at the same time, you know, want to build wind farms. That's what we do. So, we're honest, we're open. We're open to discussing, you know, just about anything with our landowners, from if they need specific exclusion areas for our facilities written into their leases or anything like that, we listen to those, we incorporate them in, and try and work with them as closely as possible on the project. They're very important partners to us on these projects, and their happiness with the project over the long term is very important to us.
Okay, as I look this over and my numbers don't come out, I seem to be off one and I didn't take the time to recalculate. So it looks to me like there are about 15 unsigned residences and about 10 signed, but three of those are unoccupied. So there's really about 7 or 8 signed ones. So about 2/3 of the residences in this area are not signed. Does that seem right?
I'd need to go and do that same math. Thing.
If that seems way off at some point, I hope someone will just interrupt.
It's consistent with the chart.
Yeah, I think that seems
wrong. We'll assume that about 2/3 of the residences out there did not sign for the variety of reasons you mentioned. And you said you have about 80 participating landowners. I'm looking for more the number of quarters of land or something like that. I mean, you can have a quarter of land that's owned by a big extended family that's got many heirs. And so here's one quarter out of thousands and thousands of acres that has 50 owners, and that really runs up the score. So as I look at your map, and I mean, there's turns, there's diagonal cuts and such, it looks generally like about 40 to 50 square miles. Out of that area, how many parcels are owned by the, how many ownership units do you have?
Individual ownership units? I don't know that off the top of my head. Are you looking for trusts, LLCs, and...
Right.
Yeah, I don't think that I can come up with that right now. But I think we're happy to provide that information.
Do you know of how much of the land that's signed, what percent of the acreage, is signed by some of those 7 or 8 residences that are in here, as opposed to landowners that maybe don't live in this area or even the state?
I think that there's maybe somebody here that could answer that question, but I don't know that myself. So.
Okay. I think we need to get back to that. That would be useful. Because I just worry with this amount of unsigned residences compared to how many are signed, does the excited landowners concept, does that mean finding an area that has wind energy development potential where most of the land is owned by people who don't live there? You know, that's different than a bunch of people living there and anxious to participate in something. So that's why we need to get to that. Now, out of this 40 or 50 square miles, generally, what percentage do you think is either tilled or is tillable? You know, like if there's CRP or hayland that's been planted back to grass or alfalfa, I'm counting that as tillable.
Yeah, I would say that an overwhelming majority of this land is tillable, or it is, as I think I described it earlier, as a agricultural wetland matrix. What folks have done is there's the prairie potholes around there that they're working around with their equipment.
Okay, I'm working back to this point. I have probably more hands-on experience with the laying of telecommunications lines and electrical lines, but I look at this map that has the purple where you're going to have your underground power lines, and when I look at about 40 or 50 square miles here of the site, it looks to me like about half of those quarter sections, roughly, has power lines on them. Are these landowners that have signed, are they aware that they will probably have to start calling one call when they do soil testing? In our telecommunications burial, I know when we bury something at a certain level, if it's usually not this deep, but I'll use the 48 inches. If you hit a stone or something under there, the machine can jump. So I presume you would not say, yes, you can dig 42 inches, we don't even need to mark it, it's safe and we'll take our responsibility. I would assume you would want to be called based on certain levels of digging. And so what I know in some places, especially in the eastern part of the state, soil testing is being done as low as 48 inches. So what's going to be the process on this farmland?
We do a couple of things to address the concerns that you're raising. You know, one thing generally is a practice we trench in our cabling rather than plowing it in, which I think is the process you were describing, where they go with a plow and the plow can adjust if it needs to, if it hits like a boulder or something underneath the ground. When we go and we trench it in, you know, we open up a corridor, we lay the cable in, we'll put the electrical cable at the bottom of the trench. We'll put a fiber optic cable slightly higher than that, and then we'll actually put a marker tape above the fiber optic cable so that if somebody is out there and is digging a hole and hasn't called us, they'll hit that marker tape first so that at least they get some warning. Then we will also have final plans for the landowners that will have, you know, basically where all of the facilities that might be buried on their land are. They can work a little bit off of those plans. And lastly, the one call is a great system, and it's a fantastic system. We'll have an operations team, and the operations team is actually there not only to ensure good operation of the wind farm, but they're there to help make sure that that landowners have easy access, that we're still a presence in the area. And if they need anything, they can call up that operations manager. That operations manager can go out to the site and verify that, you know, that the disruption to the soil that they might be proposing isn't going to adversely impact the project if they have concerns. So there's a number of steps that that our landowners can go through, and that there's a number of safety checks in there that ensure that they're not going to disturb anything that that could harm them or that could harm the project.
But at the end of the day, they will have to do one call before they soil test, because it's more than a couple feet deep.
If
is
you
that
know,
correct?
If that is what the North Dakota laws are for them to dig that deep, then they probably should be doing one calls anyways. But we ensure that we are as accessible as possible to our landowners through our operations as well. And I think that's something that's very important to us. We want to make sure that as we're a partner in these communities that we build our wind farms in, that we're there as a long-term presence and as a long-term face, and that our projects carry our reputation forward as good developers.
So when the transmission line is in 4 feet, and you said the fiber is above that, is that a couple inches or a foot or?
So there'll be just like a few inches separation. There'll be a little bit of backfill, a little bit more that go in.
Then I'd like to move in, just follow up a little bit more on the decommissioning and reclamation. You said you work with the construction company, but the construction company that builds them, as far as getting estimates of what it will cost to dismantle?
That's correct, yeah. They will have the best knowledge of what it's going to cost to decommission the project.
Are you members of the Wind Energy Association?
The American Wind Energy Association? Yes, we are.
Have there been some wind farms dismantled that are, you know, I'm not talking about Grandpa's windmill for the water tank, but, you know, some comparable wind farms where we would have some ideas of the actual costs?
Of this type of turbine model, I'm not personally aware of any. I'm aware of older turbines that have been decommissioned.
Like how big were they, about MEG ones or something?
Like the older, I think they were a lattice tower in Tehachapi, actually, is what got decommissioned.
Is there any hazardous materials? I assume there must be some oil or something to keep the rotor going, and what hazardous materials will have to be worked with when it comes time to decommission?
There's very small amounts of lubricant in the turbines. And
that's about it. In the reclaiming, you know, there's the turbine that's above ground to be dismantled and hauled away. You said you cut the concrete down to 4 feet. But you have these roads, and you said you'll fill where you cut the concrete down with topsoil. Where do you store the topsoil between now and when you're going to need it?
For restoration, we're going to need to find a new topsoil source.
So when you build the roads, don't you strip the topsoil first
Yes, and there'll be also dirt removal associated with the digging of the foundations, but that soil gets removed from the site, and you know, it may get, depending on you know what's going on in the area, somebody might have a use for that extra soil. The contractor will ultimately be in charge of figuring out how to you know best use that after it's been removed.
Well, I guess I'm more used to the coal mining, where the topsoil is maintained separate and separate for each landowner, so that one landowner that maybe is very fussy doesn't get the weeds from a landowner that is less fussy. So there's no topsoil storage here. You just build it and then.
We'll have to find. We'll have to find reclamation soil.
Okay.
If we got that request from a landowner, we'd do our best to figure out how to accommodate it, but you know that's not our practice.
And I think my last thing was, Do you have a, have you filed your 10-year plan?
Yes.
When was that filed?
It was filed, I believe, the 28th or 29th. I sent an email and it was also FedExed and delivered.
28th or 29th of June?
Oh, June, yeah. So it was right before the deadline.
You mentioned earlier our Siting Act, so you're familiar with the Siting Act?
Yes.
Somewhere in our in the previous application, there was something mentioned. I think we've been working on this since like 2008 or for a number of years, right?
That's correct. On this.
In our Siting Act, it said that every utility that owns or operates or plans within the next 10 years to own, operate, or start construction on any facility shall annually develop a 10-year plan. And so all these years have gone by, and the first 10-year plan we got was 2 weeks before the hearing.
Can I answer that one since it's a legal matter? Typically, we don't advise clients. One, they typically, sometimes they haven't disclosed or they haven't determined that they're actually going to construct anything. And in past practice, we've always made sure there was a 10-year plan filed before an application hearing on a project, but we've typically not advised them to file it before because many projects are in this such an early stage that they're not really ready to file something that says we are actually having a plan in place. So that's typically how we handle that situation. And that's been the past practice that we've understood from the commission as well, as long as the 10-year plan was filed prior to the issuance actually of the order, then there were no issues with that particular approach.
I just will say, when we talk about developing energy needs in an orderly and timely fashion, you know, to me that's part of, long before I got here, why the 10-year plans were requested.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is hard to plan the build out of things in an orderly and timely fashion. We don't have those. But that's, I guess, we didn't. So I don't think I have anything further right now. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Christman. Commissioner Fedorchak.
Thank you. Patrick, thanks for all your information so far. My colleagues have asked a number of my questions, but I do have a few additional ones, some going back to what we've already discussed in the map with all of the pink dots. So bear with me while I revisit that again. So there's areas, well, first of all, based on the chart and the map, it looks to me like there are, you have 11, I'm looking at the residences, I'm concerned about the residences. There's 11 who have signed on and 15 that have not signed. And 9 of those 15 are within the boundaries of the wind farm and actually, you know, within the red lines. So I'm curious if there's a concentration of the towers where a few of the landowners are fortunate in getting a whole bunch of them, and then some of them are getting zero, and how much effort you guys did to spread the wealth along with, especially the people who are living there, the landowners, the residences. If you did everything you can to spread the wealth and get some of the people, most of the people who are living there, some monetary benefits from this project.
There's a number of ways that our lease functions to provide our participants with monetary benefits. We, with wind energy facilities, there's very long setbacks. And one of the things that we think is really important is that everybody gets a cut of the pie, so to speak, when they're participating in the project. So one of the lease provisions we have is a per acreage payment. We pay our landowners on a per acre that they're contributing to the project. We also then have an additional payment for landowners who are receiving project facilities, and because they are ultimately getting, you know, they're going to have to farm around them. They're going to have to deal with the fact that a wind turbine is on their land. So we give them a little extra payment. While not all of the landowners in the project are necessarily receiving turbines, we are, you know, providing everybody that's participating with a payment. We also have a minimum payment for folks, because it is a per acre payment, you could have something with a very small parcel and that payment would be very low, but we also have a minimum payment for home sites, for landowners that just live in an area that may not have a lot of land.
Okay, then I think you're starting to, I'm starting to understand this map a little better, but one more question on this map. There are areas that are marked, there are properties that are marked, they're on a signed parcel I'm looking at, like H, K, G, and Q. They're on a signed parcel, but in the chart they're listed as not signed. So they're on the green parcel, but they're on the chart as listed as not signed. So explain that, how that works to me. H, K, G, and Q are some that I noticed.
H, K.
H wasn't. Sorry. Yeah, no, they're not signed. Sorry. K.
I'd probably need to look more detailed at the particulars of that situation as to why we're determining that they're a non-signed house. And
if I can help out a little bit, is that all right? If you look at the Exhibit 4, not Exhibit 3, where it shows, I believe that it's K, if you, it's harder to see, but K is actually unsigned underneath the pink. It's a little bit difficult to see.
But it's on a green parcel.
It's actually not green under there. Underneath of K is white. It's just
if you look at the Exhibit 3 map, you can, there's a...
Which exhibit are we looking at? I think Commissioner Fedorchuk is looking at Exhibit 4.
Yeah, yeah. I'm comparing Exhibit 3... I'm comparing Exhibit 3 and Exhibit 4 here, and what you can see that's not readily apparent on Exhibit 4, but you can see on Exhibit 3 is that there's a very small acreage there that is not signed, say at Residence K.
Oh, so they just decided not to.
So there's a small, yeah, there's just a very small area that's not signed, and then the broader parcel actually is signed, so... I don't know if that helps clarify the...
Does that answer your question, Commissioner?
Yeah. All right. Okay, so... then there's... Near as I can tell, there's, according to the maps, there's three townships involved, and you have letters of support from two. Do you anticipate getting one from all the townships involved, and or more simply, do all of the townships support this?
We haven't received any negative feedback from any of the townships. I don't want to speak for them.
Did you actively solicit those letters, or did those just come in on their own?
I believe we've actively solicited them. But we may have, you know, at the time, we may have only received, you know, two.
But it isn't, we shouldn't read that as an indication that the other township does not support it, they just didn't send a letter.
That's correct, I wouldn't.
Okay. Now, I have a few questions on economics, and this is just kind of in my goal to understand how all this generation facilities get incorporated into our electric industry. But first of all, you're estimating on here that these have a 43 to 47% efficiency rate, or I didn't forget the exact term, and that's quite a bit higher than typical in North Dakota. What did you use? What data justifies that high of a level of production?
We have two temporary meteorological towers on site. We also have what's known as a sonic detection and ranging system, shoots up a high-frequency noise vertically and then captures its reflection down to measure wind speed. And using those pieces of equipment, we've been able to then correlate it with data at different weather stations, both, you know, here at Jamestown Airport and more broadly, and determine what the long-term wind speed is at the site. And then using current turbine technology, we're able to model energy production off the project, and that's where we've come up with that 43% to 47% net capacity factor.
Do you think that's conservative or optimistic?
I would say that our assumptions are conservative, and in particular, you know, we assume you know, a number of things out there as far as availability of the turbines, the grid availability of the grid, and how the electrical system inside of the wind farm is going to operate, that are exceptionally conservative.
And then with the extension of the PTC and somewhat of a rush of new projects, not just in North Dakota but nationwide, the cost of the towers, is it going up? Is it going down? Are they cheaper or more expensive? Or how are you finding that compared to previous projects?
The way that the production tax credit got extended is such that I think it's still a very competitive market for folks that manufacture turbines. You know, whoever is out there has to make the sale basically by September to ensure that these projects are PTC qualified, and that is something that, you know, is basically putting a lot of pressure on the turbine vendors. We've seen turbine pricing drop significantly over the past 5 years, and you know, I don't know if it's going to go any farther down. I don't think it will, but it has. The cost efficiencies in construction, I think, have increased greatly over the past 5 years, and the operational efficiency, I think, has also increased pretty dramatically over the past 5 years.
So the turbines are less expensive?
The turbines are less expensive, and they operate better.
Help me understand for you how big of a driver the PTC is and was.
It's very important to us and to making this project work. You know, it amounts to a significant amount of the way that the PTC functions. It's not in our power price, but it's in our finance cost of the project, and it does have a major bearing on that.
Could you estimate what percentage it will help cover of your initial capital investment?
I don't want to go there right now. I don't know that off the top of my head.
Okay. And then one more question that you, so you have this signed purchase power agreement that will become public here at some point. What's your sense of how your price per kilowatt hour is comparing with existing other fuels on the market, like coal and gas-fired power?
I think that the only real way to compare our fuel prices to new generation sources, so I don't want to go and take a new energy facility of any sort and compare it to something that's been installed for 20 or 30 years.
Sure.
But I think that from a new generation source, I would say that we are exceptionally competitive. I think in our application, we provided some really interesting analyses from third parties on new installed cost, and it showed wind energy as being the cheapest out there.
Yeah. And that took into consideration PTC, though. That was with the federal's PTC, I believe.
I would need to go back to the analysis and take a look at it again.
Okay. All right, let's see, that's, I think that's for my economic questions. Hold on one second here. Oh, you eliminated the 3-megawatt tower in your listing. Tell us, why did you do that?
We weren't finding that it was price competitive with other manufacturers out there, and prices, of course, the operational efficiency of the turbine, as well as the total cost to install it.
All right, then just a few more questions here. Just out of curiosity, sorry. I'm curious about the strength of these towers in storms. How have there been any cases of them being blown over? How strong are these? I know they're bolted down into concrete, but is there any threat of them being blown over?
There's no threat of them being blown over in storms. They're designed to withstand pretty exceptional storm cases. And what we do when we design the foundations of the project is we look both at the average wind loading of the project, and we do a couple of different extreme weather event calculations, both using building codes and using a Gumbel type extrapolation, where they run a number of probability analyses on the standard deviation of gusts inside the project. And we designed to typically the gust events that we design the project to withstand on, say, a yearly event of 60 miles an hour, and we designed for very extreme events as well. But that's sort of our average. We expect that they'll see 60 mile an hour winds on an annual basis at the very least.
And the blades too, there's no.
The blades should be fine in those situations. So the whole system is actually designed, and the foundations actually take some of the loading off the blades, and in certain situations they'll start to flex back and forth.
What about tornadoes?
Tornado is not a design case for wind turbines. It's not really a design case for just any industrial facilities out there.
Boy, that would be ugly. Okay, let's see. And then one final little question here. On the Air Force, your discussion is mine on Air Force Base, tab 6. The conclusion came, I just want to clarify here, there was a series of emails. One came from the U.S. Air Force, and then it basically said there's kind of problems here, and there's some blackout information. And then I just want to confirm that the final email that was included from the Minot folks is the authoritative, yet this doesn't cause any problems.
Yes, if you read the letter originally from the Department of Defense here, it says that they wanted us to contact the Minot Air Force Base and discuss mitigation measures. Charles Hogue from Minot returned to our email with a statement that it's their opinion that the Courtney Wind Farm will not have a detrimental effect on their training route. So, I am assuming from that letter that no mitigation measures are needed because there's no detrimental effect to mitigate.
I just wanted to clarify because they were conflicting. Okay. That's it for me, Judge.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Your Honor, I have one follow-up.
Commissioner Paul.
Thank you, Patrick, for enduring all of our questions.
It's my pleasure.
I will tell you that with the exception for, and I'm not making any decisions here today, of course, but everything that I've seen so far, with the exception of the white spots on the map, doesn't give me any more concern than about any other wind farm we've done. But for to put a finer point on Commissioner Fedorchek's questions, as I look through Exhibit 3, I want to make sure that I'm tracking this. Mm-hmm. Or Exhibit 4, either one. We've got section, top to bottom, section 2, Section 11, Section 23, all have homes that are non-participating landowners that are inside the project footprint, correct?
Two.
Top and bottom. 2, 11, 23, and then the bottom straight down 12. So I see four homes that are inside the project footprint that are non-participating.
Okay, I think I'm following.
So do you agree with that?
I think what I'm seeing is there's structure or home B, home Q, and home N. Are those the ones you're looking at? I just want to make sure.
Looking at my exhibit 4, the dots that are inside there, just double checking. I'm just trying to get what we're really talking about here. We've got four homeowners that are inside the project area that are not participating, and we've got one down there in section, looks like 10, that is just outside the project area, but they're real close to it. And where I'm going with this is that certainly not making any decisions today, but it would be in my opinion, a significant shift for the commission to approve a project that has homes inside a project area that are non-participating. We've never done that before. Now, we've had very controversial cases where homes have been on the outside of the project area and the homeowners didn't want it. But in those cases, we've always said, listen, they met the setbacks and that's just the way it goes. There has to be a line somewhere. But as we get into our work sessions, I'm sure that'll be a big point that I'll talk about with my colleagues. But would you be willing to go back and talk to those four particular landowners again and see if you can get them to be part of this operation? Because I can tell you that it'd be a lot easier for me to find this approval project if that wasn't those. I'm not saying that I've made any decisions today, but I'm saying it'd be easier to get to that if they were participating landowners. I can't be any clearer than that.
I don't think that we would be opposed to going back and talking with these landowners. I can't guarantee that they will be, you know, interested in signing anything or participating. We're more than happy to talk.
I'm not saying that we're going to do one thing. I'm not going to do one thing or the other. I'm just giving it as directly to you as I can.
Yeah. I think one of the more important things for us as a company is to be good actors in the community. And
I'm trying to speak for myself only, to stick with what we've done in the past, and what we do in every hearing becomes precedent in the next hearing. And I can see 2 years down the road where we've got, if we go a certain direction, we might have landowners intermixed and some have turbines and some don't. We've really, I think, done a good job in the industry of trying to be consistent, be predictable, to keep the landowner issues at bay. The most heated hearing I was ever part of was up in Cooperstown, and it took us 10 hours. We had neighbors fighting against neighbors. And so that's what I guess my last caveat. It'd be great if that information comes along before as appropriate, but we certainly don't need it to make a decision, but I'll just offer that up.
Commissioner Christman?
Just along that line, just that we're clear, because there's a record, but when Commissioner Culp talks about 4, I think I see 7.
Fair enough.
So,
which 3 would you?
Well, I'm looking at it kind of going from the top also. X and B appear to be in the area. X and B.
That's the same two I'm talking about.
Yeah. And then G.
That's the same one.
Is on white. H is over here in a little white.
Sure.
Q is down here on white. And L just off to the left. And then N over to the right on a big section of white.
Thank you for that clarification. Commissioners, anything else?
And then if you just counted those within the boundary, they aren't in the white areas. There's two more, X and N. But those are unknown.
All right, that sounds like there might need to be a little more clarification for sure on those.
So if it's all right, we'll see what information we have currently, and then before we close the hearing, we'll discuss whether we need to provide a late filed exhibit. Is that all right?
Sounds good, Ms. Smith.
All right.
Ms. Smith, do you have any redirect?
I do. I'm trying to keep it brief. So just to clarify, I think there's a question that Mr. Armstrong asked about the shadow flicker analysis, and does it include all of the turbines? It includes the worst case scenario turbine using all of the potential sites, all 136 sites, is that correct?
That's correct.
And so it doesn't do an analysis for each turbine because that is the worst case scenario.
Yes, for us to determine that it was the worst case scenario, we had to run modeling for all of them, but we only really reported results for the most extreme scenario.
Okay, just to make sure. And just to reiterate, Stetson County does have setback requirements from non-participating landowners, is that right?
It does, yes.
And you've complied with the setback requirements from all non-participating landowners?
Yes, we have.
And we talked a little bit about the BBCS and some of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service issues and HCPs and those different issues. Are there any approvals required prior to construction from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service with respect to wildlife impacts?
No.
And so any permits that are acquired are an individual risk assessment determination, is that right?
Yes, they're all voluntary permits.
All right. And going back to Courtney Wind Farmers LLC, just to clarify, that was, were the some of the people that were interested in setting up Courtney Wind Farmers LLC, people that were looking at developing a project themselves?
Yes, they were.
And so rather than develop a project themselves, they were local people? Is that
That's
your understanding?
Correct. That's how I
so
understand.
So rather than the local people developing a project themselves, they decided they would rather invest in development with Geronimo in a project?
That is correct.
Okay. So this is really set up, it's the landowner setting up an LLC in order to be a part of a project.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes, yes.
And we talked a little bit about permanent met towers. I know in my experience, all the projects I've worked on have had permanent met towers. Is that something that you have seen as a standard in the wind industry?
Yes, it has become a standard in the wind industry.
Okay. And just to clarify on, while we have a project boundary, so we have a red line on maps 3 and 4, exhibits 3 and 4, anywhere where there are is white or anywhere that is unleased, there's no authority to place any facilities on those parcels, is that correct?
That's correct.
And so we're not, in your application today, you're not asking for authorization to place facilities or consider your project on those parcels?
That's correct.
Okay, so in effect, you could draw red lines around all of them and they would be excluded from the project itself, but they are, and you're not asking for them to be part of the project.
That's correct. Rather than excluding them from the boundary of the project, we feel it's better to include them in the boundary of the project and include that area as part of the examination of the environmental impacts of the project.
So you did it more to ensure that you were completely complying with siting criteria and review of the project site.
That's correct, yes.
Okay. So, all right. I think that's all the questions that I have at the moment.
Mr. Armstrong, any questions?
No additional questions.
Mr. Lean?
I have to understand just one question on payments to landowners. Did you say earlier that everybody inside that red line gets a payment?
Everybody who's signed an easement with us, whether they get facilities
okay, so
or not.
The white does not get
the
payment.
White folks are not necessarily getting paid. If they chose to sign an easement, we would happily have them participate in the project. But.
Okay. So I just wanted to make sure I understood that. So that's it.
I just have a point of clarification, Mr. Smith. On the, or I'm sorry. Well,
no,
that's
right,
Mr. Smith.
You can pick.
On exhibit four, or I mean three. We have to put this. correct. Exhibit 3, this map. Was it your testimony just now that those white areas inside the green, that we could envision a red border line around each of those because you would not consider those part of the area?
We would not consider them part of the project boundary, correct.
Okay, so...
Well, I guess project boundary is more loosely defined here. We would not consider them under easement, and we would not intend to put any facilities on their land.
Okay. So there isn't any kind of requirement that... I mean, these parcels can be isolated within the boundary area. There need not be any kind of a contiguous configuration. They don't have to connect somehow. They can be isolated within the area.
Are you, for us to construct the wind farm, we'd need to be able to get electrical collections to all the turbines. So total isolation between one leased part of the project and another leased part of the project is a little difficult, but you know, generally an unsigned parcel doesn't, you know, it doesn't preclude us from working around it, I guess.
Okay, look at Exhibit 3, the map there, Exhibit 3. Where it shows, it shows, you know, the collector lines, the access roads, all the turbines laid out, all of that. Just for example, I want to look at that parcel, and right in the middle, it would be where close to H would be. That little square, that parcel there, is surrounded by turbines, collector lines, and access roads. So it's one that is surrounded completely by something. And but yet that one is totally isolated. You know, some of the others, they, you know, they're not completely isolated. They're not completely surrounded. So that little parcel of land, in follow-up to what Mr. Lean just asked, they would get no benefit, but they're surrounded. They would get no payments, no economic benefit.
They wouldn't receive any direct payments from the project. That would be an accurate description.
Any more questions from anyone for this witness? Everybody's sitting and saying, don't anyone ask anything more. It's 10 after 1. All right. Thank you, Mr. Smith. You're excused. Commission, how do you wish to proceed at this point? Do you want a lunch recess? Do you want to take 10 minutes and stretch and soldier on? What is your wish?
Well, I confer with my colleagues, but I guess my thought would be that we just take a break and keep rolling, unless you're anticipating your next witness to be shorter. And I think if we take a quick break and come back, that'd be okay with me. If that's okay.
And there were 4 people that had hands up, but probably fairly short.
Do we want to get the public next, or is that...
No, we have to go first, okay. Under the rules.
Do you want, what, 15 minutes, Commissioner?
10.
10 minutes. 10-minute recess. Right. Scott? Yeah. Let's get the recorder off before we get a bunch of time to stay off.